monks reminded me at tea time that this retreat has just gone to Thursday now, so there's only actually a couple more Dhamma talks left. So he said it's about time I got into the Umphi Dhamma talks. And the Umphi Dhamma talk this evening is talking about anatta. And I'm going to bring this one up right now, because it's going to bring a few threads together of what I've been talking about so far. And I'm also going to, if the talk goes according to the direction I want it to go, I'm going to bring in how we use the perspective of anatta to develop the deeper stages of meditation. And wherever you are in your meditation, how this perspective, looking at things through the prism of anatta, can help develop the meditation into more and more profound and deeper levels. I did say in an earlier talk that it's through wisdom power that you get very deep in meditation, not through mere willpower. And a little bit of insight, a little bit of understanding, seeing this process from a different perspective, has enormous power to quieten the mind down. And so I wanted to especially emphasize in the latter part of this talk how anatta can be used in this process of meditation. But first of all, just the meaning of anatta should be apprehended by us. And it's one of those subjects, or the subject in Buddhism, which to many people is very hard to understand and to get your mind around. And that by itself is a good point for insight to arise. Why, in many parts of Buddhism, they seem to be so attractive and so acceptable, but when we come to the teaching of anatta, there's something inside of us which rebels. That is the illusion of self getting uncomfortable. And it is stirring up something which is very deep-rooted inside of us. There's something which does not want to even contemplate anatta, non-self. And that is a symptom of the whole problem. The Buddha was very uncompromising when he taught anatta. And it's one of the reasons why people find it a bit difficult, because there's no way around, when you read the Buddha's teachings, there's no way around coming to the conclusion that there is no one in here. There is no controller. There is no knower. There is no doer. There is no self, no soul, no being. And this uncompromising conclusion which you get from looking at the teachings causes you to actually investigate, because so much other teachings of the Buddha seem to be so powerful, so deep, so true, so effective, and this one seems to be the hard one. And it is the hard one because it's on the realization of anatta, of uncovering the illusion of self, that the whole path towards enlightenment revolves. This is the insight, the discovery, the understanding which changes one from just being a person wandering around samsara lifetime after lifetime to one who is on the way out of samsara. Inevitably, certainly, surely, bound for nibbana. It is the crux, the fulcrum of the whole practice. And that is difficult to see. It's difficult to see because we don't want to see it. But at least we can get a handle on what the Buddha was talking about. Because first of all, that he asked you to not look at anatta from a philosophical point of view, which is one of the big mistakes, we intellectualize it, but to start looking at anatta from the practical point of view, how it affects our views, perceptions, thoughts. In particular, to look at what do we take to be a self, a soul, a me. And this is where we really get to grips with this teaching of anatta and how we use it. Instead of thinking, now, is there a self or who am I? You say, what do I perceive myself to be? What do I perceive is mine? What do I think is me? What do I think is mine? What do I know or view as me? What do I view as mine? And here, the Buddha started taking apart this illusion, bit by bit. First of all, you've got to identify what this illusion is. The illusion is all your perceptions which assume a self, all your thoughts which conclude as a self, and all your views which think there's somebody there. What is all of this? This is what we call like the mirage, because the simile of a mirage is powerful. Because you know that the mirage, there is some aspect which is real there. A mirage is not just pure imagination. A mirage, there is real light arriving in your eyes. There is an image on the back of your eyes. The point is that the brain or the mind misinterprets what you're seeing and gives it an interpretation, gives it a label which it does not deserve. The mirage thinks it's a body of water there. Or rather, the mind interprets the mirage to be a body of water on the road, when we all know it's just the light being reflected from the sky. This is the mirage of the self. Now, in order to find out it is a mirage, we've got to actually know what this is that we're misinterpreting. We have to know this experience we are taking to be a self. And it's incredible sometimes that even the ordinary aspects of life, which we should really know better, are not ours, nothing to do with us. We take to be a self. Now, our body. We take to be a self when we're concerned about it. A self has property. A self owns things. Any person in this world has their property, their possessions, their area of control. Because what you own, you have rights over. People think that they have human rights over their body because they think it is their body. People think they have rights over their mind because they think it is their mind. They think they have rights over their thoughts. I can think what I like. Can you? These are things which we think we possess, but first of all, our body. Do you possess your body? Do you own it? Is it yours? The older you become, the more you realize just how out of control this body is. How, if there is an owner to this body, it's nature, not you. It gets sick, it hurts, it gets old, it gets better again. And you have just a little influence over this, but not that much. However, you can understand that whenever you assume this body to be you or yours, you suffer. As soon as you think that this body which the mosquito is biting belongs to you, you suffer. If you could just imagine this mosquito was biting not your body, but say this microphone in front of me. Would you worry about it? Would you be concerned about it? This microphone isn't yours. if you could actually perceive, even like through imagination, that this arm or this leg which the mosquito was biting wasn't yours, suffering would disappear straight away. The concern would be gone. There would be a sense of peace. Whenever you regard something as not yours, the result is this thing we call letting go. What is the opposite of letting go? It is called owning. I won't call it controlling, I'll call it owning now, because the owning always assumes an owner. And so we look at what we own, what we possess, or what rather we think we possess. And this is a way of accessing the teaching of anatta, using the Buddha's teaching, which I mentioned earlier, that if there's a self, a soul, a me, there'll be things which belong to me. If there's things which belong to me, if there's possessions, there has to be an owner. These two go together. So you look for the teaching of anatta, just what you think you own. What do you own in this world? Do you own your body? If you do, you suffer. If you think you own your body, you'll be attached to it. If you think you own the body, you will not be able to let it go. And I've seen many people in that predicament, close to death, in pain, not willing to let their body go. And sometimes it's very sad to see a person thrashing about in just the last few moments of their life, struggling for the breath, struggling for a comfortable position, struggling to stop death happening. And even though they're in pain, they'd rather have that pain and discomfort than have death. Why is that? It's attachment to their body. Why are they attached to their body? It's because they think it's theirs. They can't let it go. It's like a child with a little teddy bear or doll, and someone's trying to take it from you. No, leave it, it's mine. You can't have it. And you won't let that teddy bear or little doll go. You can see that in a child, and you know that the child's being stupid. But this little doll, this little teddy bear of a body we carry around with us, when nature takes it back, do you scream? Do you cry? No, no, no. I'm too young to die. I've got too many things to do. Not yet, tomorrow maybe, but not today. Not now. This is what we're talking about with attachment. And the cause of this is this mirage of self and soul. This mirage of ownership. You can actually see this happening in certain moments of your life when the body is threatened by sickness, by disease, or even just by simple pain. When there's a pain in the legs when you're meditating, what is the problem? What is the real problem? Is it the pain, or is it because you think it's my pain? Why can't you let go of the pain? Why can't you just go to the breath and just stay with the breath? If you look closely, you'll think, you'll know that you'll go to that which concerns you, which you think is your business, which you think is what you're supposed to be doing. You go to that which is your assumed responsibility, that which you own or think you own. You go to the pain in your legs because you think it's your legs. It's your pain. So you have to do something about it. If you could realize at that point, or do a little imagination, not self, this is not mine. It's nothing to do with me. It's not my concern. Let the body look after the pain. Mind look after the breath, or look after the nimitta, look after the mind. You could do it then. When you understand you don't own those things, only then can you let them go. Attachment is born by the illusion of ownership. You try that the next time you have an irritation, a distraction caused by pain in the body. Just for a moment, just to let go of the body. Understand you don't own this and it belongs to nature. And you'll find the disturbance of the pain will vanish. And you'll be free to go back to the breath or the nimitta or into deep samadhi. You won't be concerned with the body because you're not regarding it as yours. And this particular way of looking at the body becomes extremely important the deeper you go in meditation. Because there comes a time, and this is a time when the nimitta arises, when you're about to leave the body completely. And with it you're leaving the five external senses. And so many meditators experience fear at this point. It is one of the upakalesas, one of the great hindrances to attaining the jhanas. You can get to the nimitta, but you can't go in. You can't sort of absorb into it. There's some sort of something holding you back, some fear, some inability to let go. And it's good to understand what you can't let go of and why. This is where the insight starts to uncover deep-seated attachments, deep-seated illusions which cause those attachments. If you get to that point many times and investigate that, you'll find that what you're afraid of letting go of is this body and these instruments of the five senses which give us a sense of protection and security about the longevity and protection of the body. It's as if that if sight disappears, sound disappears, hearing disappears, smell, taste, and especially physical feelings disappear, we're not quite sure what will happen to this body. As if all of the guards to the safety of this body go to sleep. As if we've got no guards on our house, no alarms, no protection. We're afraid that somebody might go in and steal something or destroy our whole house. We can't let go because we're worried about the safety of that which we left behind. We're worried about letting go of the body. The only way you can pass that hurdle, or the usual way you can let pass that hurdle, is another way of just being so fascinated by the nimitta you don't realize what you're letting go of. But the very good way of passing that hurdle is to realize at that point that what you're letting go of has nothing to do with you. The body is not yours. The senses are not yours. You don't own them. You're not part of them. These are just something which you take up and use, which you can put back down again. You feel free to abandon the body only when you realize, in a very deep level, it's not yours. So you, at that stage in the meditation, a little bit of anatta, a little bit of non-self, does wonders for freeing you to go into deep jhanas. You look at that body, you can let it go. It's quite safe. It's not yours anyway. It doesn't matter if it does die in jhana. And let go of all these senses. You realize they're nothing to do with you, not your business. Leave it alone. Let it go. than this control which comes up. The control which is always trying to control what? Especially control the body. Let that go. Give it away. It's not yours. Nothing to do with you. And the control which is trying to control your mind. Trying to force it into jhanas. Trying to nudge it into jhanas. Trying to mold it this way and that way so jhanas will happen. Nothing to do with you. Let go. One of the great monks in Thailand, who's been to visit here a few times, he says when he meditates, he just does nothing. Just sits there and does nothing. And goes into deep jhanas. He's a really great meditator, and that's the way he meditates. He just gives up. Gives up the doer. And the only way you can do that is because it doesn't belong to him. Why am I doing something which doesn't belong to me? It's like mowing someone else's garden on a Saturday afternoon. What are you doing that for? Let them mow their own garden. So this is the anatta which actually starts to propel you into the jhanas. And the Buddha actually said again and again when he started talking about not just looking at the body as non-self, but look at some of the senses. He said very clearly, it's in the Anatthalakkhana Sutta, the second teaching which he gave. Sort of, what you see isn't yours. The seeing isn't yours. Sight consciousness isn't yours. And it's not you. He said, like hearing. What you hear, just hearing consciousness is not you. Smelling, tasting, touching. What the feelings in your body, they're not you. The feeling organ, the body is not yours. Feeling consciousness is not yours. Mind objects aren't yours. The mind consciousness isn't yours. The mind isn't yours. Yet he said that very carefully in order for people to understand that these senses are part of nature, and because of the nature of illusion, that the function of a mirage, we mistake these things to be something that they're not. And especially the five external senses, we are attached to these, which is why we can't let them go. We take them to be ours. My sight, my hearing, my smell, my taste, my physical touch. Because we take them to be ours, because we think we own them, we are concerned with them. Why is it that during meditation we get disturbed by sounds outside? Have you ever investigated that? The traffic outside, the sound of someone banging, or the lawnmower going, or a helicopter going overhead. Why do they disturb us? What's the point of listening to those sounds? What do we get out of it? Why do we do it? The reason why we do it is because we think that sound is ours and we're scared of letting it go. It's as if that if we don't attend to sound, it will disappear once and for all forever. We're so used to this, we've grown up with it. It's like a good friend, once they go, we think we've lost something. How many times when people have been together for many years, when one person dies and gets cremated, the other person always thinks there's something missing there somewhere, and they don't feel comfortable. Isn't it the same? That we're so used to these five senses, that when one disappears, I mean really disappears, it's not quite right. We turn it on again deliberately. We want to hear anything rather than have silence, or rather than have no sound at all. Even with the body, we've grown up with these feelings in the body. We're used to them. And when all these feelings disappear, it can feel so weird sometimes. That we're not quite used to this. As if there's something missing somewhere. We get afraid. our comfort blankets are taken away, and we just snatch them back again. With these five senses, if you realize these have nothing to do with you, sound becomes just like a telephone ringing, but it's somebody else's call, not yours, nothing to do with you. When the body starts to itch, it's a message with someone else's name on it, not yours, so you don't open the envelope. You just don't communicate with that which doesn't belong to you, which is not your concern. If you could do that, understanding the Buddha's teachings of anatta with his five external senses, it's so easy to let them go, to turn them off, not to pick them up. And if you can do that, the jhana becomes just so easy. The burden with jhana is the mosquitoes biting you, the sound disturbing you, the pain in the knees, and all the thinking about that. That's what disturbs you. If you can let go of the body, abandon the body, jhana become easy. Remember that somebody brought this question up in the question time a few days ago about that Christian monk who was torturing his body by whipping himself until the five senses got just so unpleasant that he turned them off and gave them away. That's one way of abandoning the five senses. Make them just so unpleasant you just can't stand them any longer and you chuck them away. But that's the hard way. The easy way is to realize that these things aren't yours, don't belong to you. When you can do that, the meditation just becomes so easy. You can let go of these things because you realize they aren't yours. So this is the way we can actually use the understanding of non-self to look at the five external senses and to let them go. When we go to the world of the mind, then that is much harder to let go because we have more attachment to the world of the mind than even to the world of the body and its five external senses. In particular, we have this thing which we call thought. Why is thought so hard to give up? Again, because we think it's me thinking, this my thoughts. If you could actually look upon thoughts as being irrelevant chatter, if you could imagine that all this thought is like coming from this little demon inside of you who's managed to creep in through your ear hole when you were asleep and is getting this stupid conversation going on with another demon who's gone in your other ear hole at night and having this conversation with each other is completely stupid, but realize it's not yours. Which was two little devils inside your head speaking with one another. Even that little imagination should be enough to realize this is not your thoughts, it's not your conversation, it's nothing to do with you. And that way you just don't listen to it. You don't give it importance. You realize it's not your responsibility. You don't need to listen to that commentary. You can let it go only when you realize it's not yours. With that commentary, the inner commentary is what we call the doer, because if you listen to that commentary, just so often it's giving advice, giving criticism. Very rarely gives praise, but sometimes it does that as well. It always gives orders. This is what we're talking about, the doer. This is how the doer manifests. This is the orders, the speech. This is how the doer governs you. You think something, and then you follow those thoughts. An order is given, and you do that. And this doer, this is what we call will, choice. You can actually see it happening. Not will and choice as an idea, but will and choice as an experience, which you can view happening in your mind. You can actually see the mind moving into thought, and from that thought, sort of an action following very often. This is how there's a governing of your actions of body and speech and mind. This is how volition appears to you. You can actually see it happening. And that's what I was saying is conditioned. That's what I was saying you can see the causes for. Two little demons have crawled in your ears. Not you. Nothing to do with you. Not coming from a self. Not coming from a me. In particular, nothing belonging to me. This is not your orders. These are words, thoughts, ideas, completely conditioned. Why do you think those thoughts and not other thoughts? Why do you do these things and not other things? If you look very closely, you can see the connections, how one thought leads to another, how inclinations sort of lead to another. In particular, the Buddha actually taught to really understand how thinking works and how thinking especially is full of delusion. He taught these vipalasas, it's the working of delusion. It's the physics of it, the mechanics of it. Where does thought come from? You start to, if you look carefully, that thought is built up of your perceptions. For example, whenever you have your lunch, if you perceive something to be delicious, then actually think, oh, that's really nice, I'll have some more of that. Whatever you perceive, if you perceive in a certain way, the thought follows on from that. And it gives the thoughts build up the views that this is delicious, or Bianca's a good cook, or, you know, really get good food in this place. Your views are built up by the thoughts, which are built up by the perceptions. And where do the perceptions come from? You perceive according to your views. I often give the story of when I was a young teenager and went into a pub in London for my first pint of beer, the British beer. Vastly underage, but that didn't really matter. That was just a dare with your mates. And drinking that first sip of beer and just being completely taken aback at how dreadful it tasted. You know, the actual experience was that this was really an awful thing. It's so bitter, and it wasn't to my taste at all. But the view, the current view amongst all of my friends and most of society, was this was something delicious. So that first perception came up, and by the time I finished that beer, I changed it completely, because I wanted it to taste nice. It did taste nice. And I developed a love of British beer and spent a lot of money and a lot of time drinking it. And you can see what happens there. Because of your view that this must be delicious, it becomes delicious. Your perceptions follow accordingly. And from your perceptions, you build up the thoughts. And because of your thoughts, you reinforce the views. This is how delusion happens and keeps us in this circle which we find it so hard to get out of. We look at our thoughts, we think they're true because they fit our perceptions and they fit our views. Of course they do, because they're made out of this. your views, create your perceptions. Your perceptions build your thoughts. Your thoughts justify your views. And there you go on with more perceptions, thoughts and views, each supporting each other, justifying one another. You never can see the fallacy of that. Only when you can actually start to stop those thoughts, to realize this is just a part of nature, not trusting them, not thinking they're real, especially not thinking they're yours, to be able to let go of them by knowing that this is a doer which you can abandon. Not only the doer, because the doer is one of the biggest hurdles to overcome, both in meditation and in insight practice. And many of you just know how hard it is to find a way of letting go of this doer. See if you can practice a little imaginary suggesting, just for a few moments, of non-self, not mine. But this thing, the doer, which is manifesting as your thought, has nothing to do with me, not mine, not my business. And you find it's much easier to let go of when you don't own it, when it's not your responsibility, you don't mind people taking away. Somebody, if you heard, like a thief, break into the car park and steal a car, if you went out there and found, oh, it's not my car, would you be feel the same as if you went out there and found it was your car? You can see how ownership causes the problems. We don't allow things to disappear. We can't let go of them when we think we really own them, that they're mine. So if you do a little bit of anatta practice here, it's called anatta sanya, just the perception of non-self, then you find that it's easy to let go of the thinking, easy to let go of the thought. Also, anatta means that there is no one in here, so you don't do the meditation. How can you do the meditation? Who can do the meditation? This meditation just becomes a natural process. Not you doing it, but meditation happens when you let go of you, when you allow things to disappear and to get quiet, when you for a moment actually practice anatta towards the doer. You allow the meditation to be done by non-self rather than to coming from the self, a doer, my meditation, me doing it. The other place where the illusion of self lies is in the knower. And again, we think that consciousness is us. I am the one who is conscious. I am the one who is experiencing all of this. This consciousness belongs to me. Which is also why that if one really thinks the consciousness is yours and you own it, you like to keep as much consciousness as you can. In other words, you like to experience as much as you can in this world, which is basically the way of the world. The way of meditation is actually letting go of all that area of consciousness, all those experiences which you can be indulging in this 9 days. And instead just limiting yourself to a very small area of all possible conscious experience, just the breath, just this moment, no past, no future. It's interesting what happens when you let go of a lot of the pasture of consciousness and you just limit it in just to a small paddock. Usually consciousness can just go anywhere. You'll be conscious of just anything. Go experience all the delights, all of the pleasures in the world. But here you're putting the consciousness in a very small pasture. And what happens when you've let go of so much pasture for your consciousness and you say, I'm just going to be conscious of the breath, I'm just going to be conscious of the present moment. All these other possibilities I'm going to renounce. And so you find there is freedom. There is peace. There is some happiness. Why is that? What's going on? You start to realize that all these other areas that don't really belong to you, nothing to do with you, give them away. And you find the more you can give up consciousness, the more you can let go of consciousness. Let go of the consciousness of sights, sounds, smells, tastes and touches. And things get very peaceful. Things get very nice. Things get very free. It's because that we think that consciousness is somehow ours. We're unable to let it go. We just still want to be alive. We want to hear. We want to think. Because deep down, that we don't want anyone to take it away from us. We think it's ours, we possess it, we own it, and we're not willing to let it go. If you think that consciousness is yours, then it's just so hard to let it go. At the very least, we can let go of the consciousness of the external five senses. And let's keep a little bit of consciousness of the mind. At least we're being conscious of something. But bit by bit, when one develops jhanas, one lets go of more of the pasture where consciousness usually lives. And little by little, we let go of consciousness itself. We can only enter into that final jhana of cessation, because it's cessation of consciousness. We can even let go of the last vestige of consciousness. Only when we understand that this consciousness isn't us, doesn't belong to us, only then we can let it go. People are afraid to let go of consciousness when you think it's yours. So this is actually how we can use this anatta understanding. Just use it for a few moments. Just look at the world through anatta, just as an experiment, and see what happens. Imagine you don't own anything. Imagine this body isn't yours. Imagine these five senses aren't yours. Imagine the doer isn't yours. Imagine consciousness isn't yours. And see what happens. This way you're testing out, through your experience, the teaching of anatta. You're not just thinking about it. You're not just analyzing it. You're not just theorizing about it. You're finding out what happens if you view the world through anatta. And if you can actually do this, you find the results start to come. You start to see it's a very productive way at looking at the world, looking at meditation, looking at life. It starts to come together, this meditation. And also, that when you find that actually things work in practice, it gives you an incentive, or rather gives you a courage to say, this might actually have something to do with the truth. This might actually be real. Because what is true tends to work. What is false usually tends not to work at all. And you start to question some of these assumptions you have. You start to look at these assumptions you have. And you start to challenge those assumptions. As first of all, you've got to see that those are assumptions, like ways which we being brought up, being conditioned to view the world, to view the consciousness as being mine, to view the doer as being me. And what I'm saying is to challenge that by just looking at it from a different perspective.